Philadelphia, down in that area.
But just tell me what your youngest son is doing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, your middle son.
Yeah. Well, he got a degree from Columbia in physics, captain of a football, baseball team, and he decided he was going to work for himself. And the thing he was going to do was design furniture. Hmm. That chair you saw coming in the door was, when they built a set of chairs for someone, they always built a spare in case something happened. When he gave this to his mother, that chair is worth $20,000. So, and he has a pretty thriving business in New York City, dealing mostly with millionaires in Trump Tower and places like that who don't pay their bills. Mm-hmm. He's got that all kind of problem, you know. So that's the family makeup.
Boy, well, that's quite a saga for three sons.
Yeah, and they in turn have the youngest boy, the fellow who just promoted. He's got four sons. One of them is eight, and one of them is one. They're two. And they're in between, you know.
So you've got quite a brood.
Yeah, and then the number two boy adopted two children, and the number one boy has two daughters. One's a senior at Princeton, and Frank Jr. is on the board of directors at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
Has been for a number of years, you know. He's on a couple of boards, you know.
He can make them a bit less theoretical.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's a real practical problem solver. Yeah, all right, I will look at this. Won't take your time up now.
Okay, but that's a little thing we did with the Electrochemical Society.
Yeah.
The Electrochemical Society is one of... See, if you look on the back there, you see all the organizations which... It's really the chemical community.
The Electrochemical Society in this country, it was an offshoot, was it not, of the English Electrochemical Society?
I don't
think... They called it the Faraday Society, didn't they?
The Faraday Society in the UK, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which the Electrochemical Society in the United States, I've not... looked into this yet, but it's always surprised me. It was founded in Philadelphia, you know, which
I didn't know.
Kind
that.
Of seems that you always have the mental imagery of Niagara Falls or something like that. But Philadelphia is where it started, like many another thing.
Well, I'm wondering about them. All right, we'll put this over here. Yeah.
Okay. I'd really like to start at the beginning and just
take over.
Say this is an oral history interview with Frank Biondi on the 19th of March 1996, mm-hmm. as part of the Electrochemical Society's Oral History Project. And Mr. Biondi, can we just begin with a little bit about your own background, your family, your undergraduate career, and how you got into the chemical world?
Yeah, well, I was born and raised in the Allentown, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania area. And after graduating from high school, I worked for a year for Mack Trucks in order to earn some money to charge college. My father had come down with multiple sclerosis, and so I had a sort of shift for myself. But anyway, I ended up in the class of 36 at Lehigh in chemical engineering, which at Lehigh means you take all the courses a chemistry student takes, plus the engineering courses, you know, heat engines and physics and metallurgy and things of this sort. So I had to make a choice when I was ready to graduate, whether I should stay on and do some teaching and take a graduate degree there. And while I was thinking about it, the man I worked for, the professor I worked for, Harvey Neville, sent me down to New York to work for the Bell Laboratories on a summer job where his former roommate from Princeton, R.M. Burns, was the chemical director.
Okay.
So I took a job there for the summer, and before the summer ended, this is in 1936, someone who I didn't know, a chemist, died, and they decided to ask me to take the job. And I was worried about my obligations to Leah. I said, don't worry, we'll take care of that. There's probably 10 people standing in line for that job right now. So it was sort of a job that didn't pay very much, but you could take all the courses you wanted free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. You took over for various professors, correct their papers, teach some of their courses, things of this sort. So I ended up at Bell Laboratories instead in 1936. Now, it happened that the Bell Laboratories hadn't hired any professional people since 1936, 7 years. And I didn't realize at that moment, but I realized later what a wonderful opportunity it was, because there was no one ahead of us for promotion and things of this sort. If you wanted a promotion, sometimes that's not a good deal, because it turned out later that I got promoted very early on, and I became a manager instead of being a chemical engineer. In fact, the Bell Lab didn't even realize I was a chemical engineer. They thought I was a chemist.
Yes, that was a little unusual. They weren't
right.
They'd be hiring chemists.
That's so. Right. And when I told them that I was not trained to be a chemist, I didn't want to be a chemist, and I was not going to be a scientist. I'm an engineer. Well, we'll put you into the Western Electric Company, but stay with us for a couple of years. You know, the Western Electric Company builds the equipment, and so there I was. The first thing I did was I registered at Columbia University for graduate work, and since I had to work at Bell Laboratories for the magnificent sum of $28 a week, I turned down a job in Philadelphia to take the job in New York, because I liked the idea of being in New York City, and their office at that time was down in the Greenwich Village section. Mm-hmm. I passed up a job with Sun Oil on Passyunk Avenue in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd have done better with them financially. But there I was. I found myself amongst an interesting group of people from two reasons. One, they hadn't added any new blood for 7 years. Secondly, the Bell Laboratories was formed by the AT&T Company and the Western Electric Company, a manufacturing outfit. By combining forces, people that were working with materials. So the AT&T people tended to be academic. The people they assigned to Bell Laboratories was what people were titled to be members of the R&D department, Research and Development Department. The Western Electric Company just called their people engineers. And they put them in an old building down in New York City that Western Electric used. And you had two sets of people trying to solve the same problems. One was brand new, one was an old organization that wasn't going to give any grounds to these new academic types who were more interested in writing papers and attending meetings of the Electrochemical Society, amongst other things. They never wrote papers. All they did was they knew about materials from raw experience, and they compared three or four people trying to sell people. Salesmen told them how good their materials were, and then they made some tests, but they were not an academic organization. Now, I found myself in an academic part, but I was really interested in working for the other group, and this caused all kind of dislocations. I wasn't very happy about the spot I was in, so after I got the degree from Columbia, the master's degree in chemical engineering, I decided to take a PhD program at Columbia, and I was just starting on that when a couple of physicists, Nobel Prize winners, came over to what they thought was a chemical department, but it was a chemical engineering department, and wanted to know if they had a young man who they could send over to the physics building where they were working on a secret program.
This is at Columbia.
At Columbia. Now, this turned out to be the Atom Bomb Project, the Manhattan District Project. At that time, the Germans and the Japanese and the English knew that if they took uranium ore, which is 0.7% uranium-235, which is what you want to pull out because it's unstable, the rest of it was 238, which was stable. That was a junk of the process. They all knew that if you dissolve this ore in hydrofluoric acid, you generated a liquid which, when heated, was a gas, uranium hexafluoride.
Mm-hmm.
And if you passed this, one technique to separate out the uranium-235 was to pass it between sheets of metal that had tiny little holes in them, and the lighter element had a longer mean-free path. And if you did this 20,000 times, they figured you would get from 0.7% U-235 to 90%, which they thought might make a bomb, you know. Well, I spent a couple of weeks, mind you, I was paid by Bell Labs. I was working at Columbia University on weekends and evenings on a PhD program. Hadn't picked out a thesis yet, a title. And after 2 weeks or so, I told them there were five Nobelists over at the physics building who were trying to act as engineers. Mm-hmm. This is a classical engineering problem, you see. This is like petroleum refinery engineering, except it was with a gas, you know, multiple stage things. I said to them as I left, they work with flat sheets like about a foot wide of nickel manganese alloy, and they dissolve the manganese out, leaving little holes, or small holes. And these two sheets were put opposite one another in some kind of a holder, which was made out of nickel, so the hydrofluoric acid wouldn't attack it. You had to be very careful not to let tiny amounts of water in, because that would make hydrofluoric acid, you see. And what would happen if the pumps varied in their speed or shut down and started up, you know, a pulse went through this. And that stuff shattered. It was all full of holes. And they wanted me to do something about it so it was stronger, but don't change the dimension of the holes, you know, offhand. It doesn't, it's not reasonable to even try it, but I spent 2 weeks at it. And I tried various techniques, heat treating here, borrowing a furnace from somebody, rolling it, it all changed. And I told him, you're doing it the wrong way, you're doing it the hard way. Why don't you take that sheet and put a piece of cloth behind it and roll the whole thing up into a tube. That's much stronger, even though it's a weak material. And I went out to the men's room and got two pieces of bathroom tissue to show them how weak they were as flat. I rolled one up with a couple of pieces of scotch tape. It had reasonable strength. So they said, well, why don't you do that for you? Well, I said, you know, I'm trying to get a PhD here. I work for Bell Labs. Well, we'll talk to your people down there. We'll get a contract for Bell Laboratories to do this. And you can work on it down there in one of their office buildings. And I did it in a matter of, there were about five different ways to separate it. One of them was a gaseous diffusion program. That's the one I was going to work with. Another one was a thermal diffusion program. There was another one was ionized the material and separated in a mass spectrograph kind of a thing. And they started to build a plant down at Oak Ridge. You know, clear the ground, put in a power plant. They had the slightest idea where they were going to get this so-called gaseous diffusion barrier. This is all in the history of books that are laying over there, you see. Yeah. I finally decided that the way to do this is to take nickel powder, which I got from Mond in Wales, where they take low quality nickel ores, and the way they extract the nickel was they expose it at high temperatures, ground up at high temperatures to carbon monoxide, and they make nickel carbonyl.
Yeah.
And then they decompose it, and you get a particle, a bunch of particles looked like, at high magnification, like a bunch of grapes. Mm-hmm. And this is great because you put a bunch of grapes together, you get a lot of torturous pads. Oh. And what I did then, I mixed this all up in toluene with polystyrene. And then I rolled out a sheet and went down to the secondhand machinery area of New York City and bought a roller that operated on DC, so I had to get a DC connection. You know, modern labs don't have DC, but I found one lab where they were trying to come up with the first television system by mechanical means, a bunch of screens or something, rotating screens. And they had a circuit board that they could call on a generator down in the basement to give them anything up to a couple hundred volts DC. It was great. Maybe somebody was looking down from above, giving me all this handy stuff. Well, I found out I rolled a sheet, and then I had to get the plastic material out. And what I did was I built a furnace that would go up to about 1,000 degrees centigrade, and I borrowed some platinum from the metallurgy department to make the heating helmets around. And what I did, I put this flat plastic sheet containing mostly nickel and heated it up very gently in nitrogen. And as I heated it up, I decomposed, depolymerized the polystyrene. And then I shifted over to a hydrogen mixture, hydrogen and nitrogen. And then I sintered together these nickel particles. But one had to be very careful in heating it up to chase out the organic material. You couldn't overheat it, because if you cracked it, you form carbon. And that, you can't remove that very easily unless you put a little water in the hydrogen. And so I didn't have chance. I couldn't go out and buy the kind of equipment you could buy today to make all these determinations and controls. I just had to use common sense. Maybe that's what engineering was in those days. I worked out a program where I could heat it up and produce this sheet about 2 feet long, about 8 inches wide, of pure nickel, centered together. It had considerably more strength than this manganese, the deprived nickel that they were using up at Columbia. And I would take little samples out, and we would measure the throughput and ability to separate a mixture of helium and carbon dioxide. And from that, we could calculate to what the heavier elements might do. Because we were not allowed to work with radioactive materials in a commercial building, and I didn't want to get involved with that part of it. I would send samples up to Columbia once a month, and they would measure it with the radioactive material and give me a number, the separation factor and the throughput. Because a good separation factor was no good unless there was volume going through there. They figured they needed couple of hundred pounds of uranium-235, not milligrams, which all my competitors were making milligrams and grams of this stuff. And mind you, I was 26 years old at the time, and I had nobody with muscle behind me to represent me on the Columbia campus. Harold Urey, who was my boss up there, didn't think the whole thing was going to work in the first place, the whole business of designing the bomb and all that, you know, which I was not involved. But anyway, one after another, these programs fell apart, and they were actually thinking of scrapping the gaseous diffusion program because nobody could produce a barrier. We, the English, the Germans, or the Japanese, they were all working on it. And then somebody remembered, who's that young kid from Bell Labs who's up here? He sends us samples. They look pretty good, so let's see what. They took me up, plucked me in a physics building at Columbia. They told me to send all my stuff up to Columbia, which I did because it was supposed to be owned by the government, including the $40,000 worth of platinum. It was the winding in my furnace. It was in a junk pile up there. They called a junk contractor in, and for so much, he picked it all up and threw it away somewhere in the dump. I tried to figure out how to get that $40,000 worth of platinum out. There's no way I could figure out how to do it. I wasn't a successful crook, you know. Didn't belong to me anyway. It belonged to the metallurgist who loaned it to me. So we had to finally pay them on the government contract for that $40,000 worth of platinum. The reason I use platinum is it's a very good heating element. And in those days, the war was on, and I couldn't get the standard heating alloys, like the thing you have in your toaster, except in bigger shape, because I didn't have the right priorities.
Yeah.
But I could get platinum. Nobody mind if I used platinum, you know. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, the Columbia people tried to reproduce what I was doing, and in the meantime, what I had done before I left Bell Laboratories, I took a sheet of this, three sheets about that long, spot welded them together and made a tube out of it of the 5/8 inch diameter, which I lured out of the window of the 6th floor building downtown to a colleague of mine who was waiting in a taxi cab on the sidewalk down below with the roof open. I couldn't take it out because the elevator just wouldn't fit. And people would ask questions, what is all this, you know? And I took it up to a meeting at Columbia. They said, by God, it works. I had a piece of canvas. I rolled it up like I had watched some people who were rolling their own cigarettes to see how they do it with this flimsy paper, you know? They back it up with a piece of cloth and a roller roller. And they thought, well, God, this guy can produce some material. It has the right kind of properties. It's rugged compared, you know, and it has a potential of producing pounds of stuff, not grams. And they were trying to figure out where they were going to do this when the chief engineer, which was Carbide, Union Carbide, came down and said, you academics, you're going to follow this whole thing up. We're taking it over. So they took us over, so I went to Niagara Falls, where they had an installation up there where they were going to do this. And I taught them everything I knew. And what I didn't know in the meantime, my management at Bell Laboratories didn't want to be involved in this program. They didn't want anything related to a bomb that might kill people to be a product of the Bell Laboratories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what they did, they stopped pursuing 7 patents that I had pursued in the name of the government, a government-owned contract. But the Bell Laboratory Patent Department would apply for these patents. As a matter of fact, the man who was doing it turned out to be the best man at my wedding. And he isn't around anymore. But to make a long story short, the Bell Laboratories transferred all my patent applications to Union Carbide. And if you look in the history books, which is the black one, you find that some guy at Union Carbide, in the Bakelite Corporation, was the guy who invented the system I'm talking about. I was told to cut my ties with this atom bomb thing and get back to work at Bell Laboratories. That's what I was told.
So when was that?
Oh, that must have been in, let me see. I decided to write a history of the things I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in code. The code is my handwriting. I once won a $5 million case for AT&T because no one could read my handwriting in my notebooks. And if I were dishonest, I could say what I wanted to do about it. But actually, I was not dishonest. I read it. And the company that was violating our patents at that time was National Cash Register that AT&T bought 5 years later. Now, let me see. Early work, Manhattan District was a book. Went up there August of 41, so it must have been 42 or 3 that I got back to Bell Laboratories. Yeah, here it is, 42. I was 28 years old at that time. And by the way, before I left it, I went down to Washington and got a Secretary of War Stinson was in retirement, but he met me in the White House, shook my hands, and gave me this piece of paper in his little tiny medal, and it says here, participated in work central to the production of the atom bomb, thereby contributing to the successful conclusion of World War II. This certificate is awarded in appreciation in August 1945.
Yeah. Wow, that's very fine.
He gave me a $1 bill and made me sign a receipt for it. Because that was all the government was going to pay for it.
Yes.
You see, while all this was going on, the Bell Laboratories was paying my salary.
Yeah.
They decided it would be too complicated to have it work for them, you know.
Hmm.
Ain't up here. Mm. Beat, but
Well, that's very interesting, complex chemical engineering, but it's a long way from electrochemistry.
Yeah,
isn't it?
In the meantime, you see this? I was an ordnance officer, and they wanted to call me up to duty. See, I'd been made a second lieutenant and a gentleman by an act of Congress. Did you know they do that? I didn't know it either. They not only make you an officer, but they make you a
gentleman. That's nice.
So, by act of Congress. Well, I keep that there in case some burglar comes in or something. So, here I was, and disconnected from this thing, What I didn't know is the material that was the junk from the process of separation, U-238, they sent out to Washington, state of Washington, where there was an installation, and they bombarded it in a carbon pile and stuffed some more neutrons in the nucleus and made plutonium, which is even better than uranium-235. Well, the gossip I had to finish this thing was that using my barrier at Oak Ridge, which they fitted in after everything was put there, they made enough material for 2.5 bombs. I didn't know about plutonium at that time. They used the first one in Trinity for a test. They didn't know it was going to work. In fact, they were afraid it might overwork. It would keep on going and destroy the whole state. Now, they actually talked about concerns. Yeah. When they worked at the University of Chicago under the Athletic Stadium where they had their laboratory, they were afraid it was going to take off and they couldn't control it. Fermi was there. He learned how to control it with the carbon rods. Well, anyway, the Trinity thing worked. That was about September, I think, but I wasn't quite sure. I wasn't involved in that phase of it. And while I was not supposed to know about it, in any big organization like that, there's always an underground information going on. The spies can steal everything that way, and they did it.
Yeah.
The Russian knew about it. We were living with a bunch of guys in New York who seemed to be more interested in Russia than they were in the USA.
Yes.
The Daily Worker was a paper they read. I read the Herald Tribune, which says one belly up. Anyway, then they packed. They were able. In the meantime, they were designing the bomb, and they, as you know, dropped number one on Hiroshima, and then number two, which I didn't know about, was a plutonium bomb. And they never tested that. They dropped it for the first time. That was the test.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually had another bomb built in that bomb in case it didn't work so it would explode the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese at that time were still enemies, might get an advantage of where we were, you know. Well, we had enough then. We tested one bomb. We dropped one. We had a half a bomb's worth left over. If the Japanese had held tight, we'd have to work another 6 months before we could get enough to drop another one on them.
Yeah.
Well, it was all over. No, just to show how the thing works. My wife, she wasn't my wife at that time, she was in Atlanta working for an aircraft company, the B-29, which dropped the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
How's that? She called me up and said, President Truman has just announced they dropped something called the atomic bomb in Japan. Well, you know anything about it. And I said, gee, well, what makes you think I know something about it? Well, she said, you came down to visit me in Atlanta once, and you took me to a movie about Madame Curie, and you explained a lot of things. You seemed to know more about radioactivity than the average person. And this was announced, I figured that's what he was doing. See, I was in West Virginia at the nickel company making these things.
Yeah.
Well, so much of that history. So,
when you went back to Bell Labs.
I went back to Bell Labs and got into the electronics business, and things were really exciting in those days. One of the group I had worked with, which were all chemists, had moved to New Jersey. I didn't want to go to New Jersey in a new lab.
When was that move?
That was about 43 or 4, but I can't put a good date on it. I stayed behind it and got into this. Across the street there was a building where we designed and made electron or vacuum tubes. But at that time, we were up to our hips in trying to help the English with magnetrons for the defense of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And the big problem was these magnetrons were built and shipped out with a PhD with each one of them, because each one of them was different, you know. wasn't like building cars, they were all alike. And then they had a tremendously short life, like 20 or 30 hours. Which maybe it's all right if you're fighting a battle and you can get new people and new... But there was no long-term solution to the radar problem. The Russians, I mean, the Germans apparently didn't have radar at that time. And so the first job I was put on, see what you can do about this cathode, which is bombarded by these high voltage bombardment. And it was a sleeve of nickel, about like a pipe, about an inch in diameter, in this big one. Inside was a heater. And if you heat this nickel sleeve, the outside is coated with a mixture of barium and strontium carbonates, which you break down to the oxides, and then when you heat them up in a vacuum, you get little patches of barium and strontium metal, which reacts with some of the carbon coming out of the nickel sleeve and gives you a flow of electrons with the proper voltages on them to the cathode. And that back bombarder would blast that stuff off. So it had short life. So, mind you, I came from a place where I built something which was a sponge. So I went right back to Columbia and got a pound of the metal and made a sponge of the nickel metal on the solid nickel anode. And then put these carbonates in the holes. So, and then when they were reduced to the oxides and the metals in the vacuum, the back bombardment didn't affect them nearly as much. And we got a couple hundred hours in a matter of a month. So I became an expert. I didn't even know which end of the tube to plug in. You know, this is just common sense. And so the electron tube guy said, hey, you know, we need a guy like you over here. So I moved my office from the main building over to this, it's an old biscuit factory they were in, and I had all kind of problems, which I loved because they were real problems, you know. I wasn't going to write a paper and publish it in Electric Chemical Society, which all the people I left seemed to, it was sort of a graduate school. And that's one of the reasons they weren't succeeding with the other half of the crowd, which came from the factories, who never read a paper, never published one, couldn't care less. They wanted to know how did it work. And this is where the two people... I found out when I got over there, for example, everybody who designed a tube designed a cathode. Hello? Yeah, you take it, Jenny? Good, thanks. So here was, these were mostly electrical engineers and a few physicists who took the wrong road somewhere and became practical people rather than theoretical people. I made an analysis. There were something like 20 different analyses of nickel to be used to make vacuum tubes with. Each one who designed a new vacuum tube said, that's my composition. They were even secretive about the damn thing. So I looked at it and decided what they really wanted was somebody wanted a highly active nickel, had a lot of carbon in it, they came out and reduced the strontium, oxide to strontium, for example. Then there was the, if it was a weak performer, very little amount of carbon or other tungsten, for example, there's a whole range of these things, you would get long life. However, if you wanted a tube to go into the broadcast business or into the business of magnetrons, you wanted something that gave you a high activity, and high activity is generally associated with low life. You know, low activity, long life. Now, in the telephone business, the whole activity was generally for long life. And in those days, if tubes lasted 20,000 hours, I thought that was great, like 2 or 3 years. I thought that was pretty bad, you know. But the interesting thing about it was that I went to I went to ASTM at that point. You know them in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
And said, I joined their committee B4, which is on heating alloys. And then it was in that committee that, at my suggestion, we standardized on three alloys of nickel for the electron tubes. I did this because it would make it, the Bell system bought a small amount of the total needed in the country. People making tubes for radios. That was just before the days of television, but the radio business was a big business. They bought their stuff by the ton. We bought it by the pound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if we could get what we wanted to be used by everybody, it would be in our interest. And I sold my medicine on this. And they said, go pursue it. Then I thought about, the problem is they worked by committee. There was a glass committee. If we wanted to be sure to have a specification describing what the glass we use in our electron tubes was, we had to go to the glass committee, which was interested in windows,
mm-hmm.
primarily, glass bottles. And but they had to write this thing, so we didn't get very much. When we wanted steel rods, we had to go to the steel committee. They were interested in railroad tracks. So I went to the board of ASTM and said, why don't you start a new set of committees instead of a committee for each type of material? How about a committee for all the materials for our industry? And they agreed to it. And we organized the first one called the F committees, F1,
mm-hmm.
for all the materials for the electronics industry. I remember F2, I think, was all the materials for the surgical industry. No, that's a big deal. They had never thought of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And if we wanted to write a standard on steel to be used, or tungsten to be used, or glass to be used, we did it. We the people in the electronics industry, not a bunch of other people who regarded this as a nuisance.
Yes.
You see? So you get to see the pattern. I was the organizer. And as soon as I got that organized, I dropped out of ASTM. They wanted me on their board. I said, no, I got other fish to fry. In the meantime, I'd gotten married, and children were coming along, and I got involved in community affairs, you know. You see, I was mayor of the town, you can see. And I was chairman of the board of a 450-bed hospital. So...
you lived a quiet life.
Yeah. My wife complained about it because she had to take care of the family. You know? Can't see if she's in here.
Jenny?
Yeah.
Here, hang on. Come on down. I'll introduce you.
This is Arnold Thackeray.
Hi,
Jenny.
As we're having a good conversation here.
yes, nostalgia.
Seems to have been a busy man.
In those days he was, very. He spent a great deal of time at the ASTM.
Yeah, in the early days, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which ran the hospital in the evening, was that?
Well, that started in 56. That was the year our third son.
I told you, we were both involved in community affairs. She was on a planning board and things of this sort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Plus, we had three boys in Little League and basketball and football. You know the story.
Well, I was one of three boys myself, so I know how that works from a mother's point of view.
It was great. I grew up with three brothers, so I enjoyed having the three boys. But... it goes by much too fast.
Yeah.
I mean, there, the oldest one is 51, and the youngest is 39. So, you know, I keep thinking of them as the boys, but they're far from that.
Yeah.
Well, I've enjoyed being here. Sit down and resume your conversation.
As a matter of fact, there's a picture on the Columbia campus. The building I was working in is right over here, mm-hmm. outside the picture. You know, they're now trying to collect $1 billion.
Oh, yes.
And they suddenly discovered I went to school there.
Yes.
Well, you asked a question there.
Yeah.
So.
That your position in Bell Labs was...
Well, as soon as I got to this, over into this building where the people designed electron tubes, they thought they had, they remembered they had a chemist somewhere in the building. They got him and I became a supervisor. Mm. Before you know it, I had 4 or 5 people. So I was concerned about them, seeing they were on the good programs, and I was starting to let go of doing things with my own hands, which I didn't like very much, because here I am, just out of school for 3 years, and before you know it, I was doing things that I wasn't trained to do. I wasn't trained to be a manager. Mm. And I didn't like it very much, you know. Merit radios and rate radios and hiring people. In my 43 years with Bell Labs, I hired 90 PhD-trained, mostly chemists and metallurgists and electrochemists, things of this sort. I fired 2 of them out of 90. And to get those 90, I had to look at 900 of them. 10-to-1 was the ratio. See, we had a system, people from all the universities in the country and even overseas, looked at graduate students in their first year, and kept track with them for 2 or 3 years, so by the time they're ready to graduate, we had all kind of information on these people. It was a real good system.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a recipient at Friday Day. Other people would interview them, and they finally got down to the point where they thought I ought to make it an offer. I would then interview the person, you know. In the last couple of years I was there, it was really bad. It was, in my last 2 years, I didn't see a single Caucasian boy. Mm-hmm. They were all Orientals.
Yes.
Most of them didn't even speak English.
Yeah.
And, but they were apparently bright people. I hired 2 or 3 of them, especially one electrochemist to hire, Yutaka Okinaka, a Japanese boy, very bright. And he did very well for us. And he was given awards by the Electrochemical Society. And Dennis Turner, who you talked mm-hmm. to, I pulled him out of the chemistry department, brought him over into, I was no longer in the chemistry department, I'm now over in applied groups. By that time I was in the transistor business, because shortly after the war ended, about 1948, I sat next to Bill Shockey, who got the Nobel Prize, you know, for he and 2 others. I lived with it amongst the physicists, not amongst the chemists. They regarded me as a different person because I wasn't a chemist. There is a lack of ability for physicists and chemists to talk to one another.
Yes.
And but I had sort of carved out a spot amongst the physicists where they would talk to me. In fact, they did most of their work, other than the theoretical work, in my laboratories. Now, my people helping them. By that time, I probably had about 40 people working for me. So we dropped the tube work and got involved in the early days of germanium. Of course, germanium isn't used anymore. And by the way of organizing, you can see I edited a couple of volumes. Transistor Technology was the first publications. Well, yeah. Actually, the first one was a secret manual. The Army came in and decided that they didn't want anybody to know about this thing that we call a transistor.
Yes.
Okay. That's good.
Good. Believe it or not, the Army thought we could keep this thing secret. So they put a secrecy label on everything, including a volume that I and others helped put together. And it wasn't until about 5 years went by that we persuaded them to make this thing public. This way we could get patents on the various ideas involved. And that's where publication comes in the Electrochemical Society, for example. At that time, I had a bunch of chemists working for me, or metallurgists, who could only, and they were working with physicists generally, occasionally an electrical engineer who were designing semiconductor devices. And every time they had any kind of a new idea that they tried out in small scale, they were publishing it in the American Physical Society publications.
Mm-hmm.
Because the principal team member was generally a physicist. And it was a journal that was not read by other chemists and other metallurgists. And they were unhappy about it, publishing in these vague journals.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in Phys reviews, new ideas would come out, you know, quick. And the patent department was very interested in having us do this to beat other people to the punch. That's where people were all over the country who were in. And the new Japanese who came in at the time and bought licenses from the Western Electric Company to use our patents. So I had to do something about this, and that's where I met with the president of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers and the president of the Electrochemical Society.
Who was that?
I don't remember his name, but he was R.M. Burns ran this as almost his private publication for years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who took his place. But whoever it was, I met with him and I was going to propose the Electrochemical Society as probably the best place for my people to publish in. I wasn't thinking of starting an electrochemical division for the society. That developed.
Mm-hmm.
The American Chemical Society was a respected old society, many divisions, you know, tremendous. They talked, they're in the 60,000 or so, whatever it is. I don't know what it is today.
150.
Is that what it is? Yeah. I have all our insurance policies, by the way, everything. I've been in 56 years, I've been a member. There's a CNE News, you know?
Yeah.
Which I look at all. Anyway, the metallurgical people had one of the principal people I had involved was in the Metallurgical Society. He tried to get their publication to be the one that would be the flagship for the process activity. There's a lot of processing in semiconductors, a lot of etching, a lot of plating, a lot of deposition of oxides, for example, from gaseous mixtures of various sorts. And, you know, the ratio of designers of solid-state devices to people who make them, the chemists, the metallurgists, is about 8 to 1. Because one designer can keep 8 process people busy,
mm-hmm.
building all the various pieces of equipment that had to be built, things of that sort, mm-hmm. and new ideas. But anyway, I conceived the idea and sold it with a little foot dragging on the part of some of the other societies. IEEE wanted to handle it. And I said, they had no history in this business. And they were compartmentalized too. They had people interested in batteries, but only because of power. They weren't interested in low power batteries or things like that. Or even solar cells. Which some of our public relations guys inadvertently called them batteries, you know. I used to get on to a town there about to get my hair cut at noon. The barber says, how's your battery doing? I said, what's this guy know about my battery for? and I was doing fine. Next time went down, he asked me again. I said, look, he asked me that a month ago. Why are you interested in the battery in my car? Oh, I'm interested in the battery in your car. I'm about, you're from Bell Laboratories, aren't you? Yes, yes. They have invented a new battery. Oh, I said, that isn't a battery. That's a public relations guy called that. It's a photocell. It's a PN junction, which when exposed to sunlight generates electrons. And sure, you can, might call that a battery, but it's not. That's what he was. He was trying to be nice, so that he knew about Bell Laboratories and Barber, you know.
Yeah.
Talking to people. So,
where did your own connection to the Electrochemical Society begin? Is that through R.M. Burns?
No, it wasn't, surprisingly. I should have done that, perhaps. I went to one of their meetings. Some of my people were publishing papers in it because they were members.
Papers on what sort of stuff?
Well, on the solutions to selectively etch, for example, trenches of a certain size and width and things of this sort, and electroplating, contact zone, things of this sort. So I met some of the leaders, I don't know who they were at the time, had lunch with them, and said, I'm proposing to our people that they publish all their papers in the Electrochemical Society journals and present them in Electrochemical Society meetings. And how do you react to that? Would you be welcome? And well, they had to think about it for a little while. So in the afternoon, they called me somewhere on the hall. They said they talked about it. They decided it was a pretty good idea. And would I help organize it? I said, would. I just want to tell you one thing. I'm not a member of this society. Oh, you're not? We thought you were. Well, we'll take care of that right away. So they... I don't know, I wrote a check out or something, whatever the fee was. I became a member of the society.
This was in about what year?
Oh. I would say this is in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, for a while, I attended a lot of their meetings. I chaired some of them.
And they hadn't got a division at this time for solid state.
That's right. Then I found I was spending more of my time in the halls talking to people and worrying about is the projector for that meeting there or not, you know? Did so-and-so arrive or not? I wouldn't attend any of the papers. I was in the hallway. I said, this isn't for me. It's a waste of my time. So I sort of left the society at that point. I got involved in other things, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I was.
When was that?
Again, this is. I kept the journals coming for years. I hated to throw them out. In fact, I had such a collection of them that I tried to give them away to small universities and they didn't want them. Finally, I found out there was the Chinese would take them for their universities. The only catch was I'd have to pay to ship them there, box them up, and apply for an import license. You better give me a hard time. I'm trying to do this, so I told them, you know, run up a tree. I finally threw them away.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were old journals, but this would be great for people who are starved for material.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't supply over the dates. I have. One moment, page. Where am I here? I try to put dates down. I'll call various people. Like, for example, I have Paris tubes down there. Before I left the tube business, the military, when the Germans left Paris, they took the tubes out, the switching tubes out of the exchanges. Not all of them, but enough of them, so they were inoperable. Well, they flew those over to the U.S., believe it or not. And I was called in one morning to talk to someone in the what do you call that department? Down in the people who deal with signal department, I guess it's called. They wanted us to make a couple of hundred tubes, all that was necessary, and they had three samples of three different kinds of tubes. We looked them over and we decided, well, I think we can do this, but it'll take us at least 36 hours. Can't you do it faster? You know, we want to get these changes and all that. So we brought some cots in, had the cafeteria across the street, bring over stuff to eat, and we worked right through around the clock for about 24 hours. One fellow was, first of all, the electronics guys had to test the tubes to find out what their performance was like. And then the mechanical guys, we took them apart, we measured the thickness of everything. And by God, we sent those tubes back in less than 30 hours. And we never heard from them, so they must be working. You think they let us know, you know. Never told us. If we thought they let us know if they're not working. The Germans expected to be back, see?
Yeah.
That's why they took the tubes out. They didn't want to destroy the exchange. They really thought they were going to get back, I suppose.
Hmm.
Well, I shouldn't have turned that page there.
Yeah. The, can we just talk about...
Yeah, here's ASTM here.
Hmm.
You lead the question.
The creation of solid-state activity within the electrochemical society. I mean, that's...
As I recall, for the time I was with them, that they were concerned mostly with process problems, as I say. We had a lot of etching to do. The way you etch a design into silicon or germanium beforehand, you coat it with an oxide of the silicon or the germanium, or you put sometimes silicon dioxide on germanium, and then through a photo process, you put a photoresist on it, and by a photo, you impress a design.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put it in essence, and you etch out where the photoresist has not been activated by the light. And that's the way... Now, this is no longer physicists now. These are... In those early days, we made our own photoresists before we got I got Eastman Kodak involved in the thing, and they became the principal supplier. But it took them 5 years to crank up speed. In the meantime, we had photoresists that were better than other people's photoresists. Other people had techniques for etching that were better than our techniques. And after they patented these things, it'd be nice to share these things amongst one another, you know. But the Electrochemical Society, as I recall, was not very much involved in growing single crystal silicon or single crystal germanium before then. Or that was all done in the Bell Laboratory, and I don't know where they published that work, because I wasn't involved in that aspect of it. The metallurgist had to across the street in another building. I was more involved in, once the silicon was grown, how you slice it, how you oxidize it, how you impress a pattern on it, how you etch that pattern, how do you make contacts on that pattern, then how do you encapsulate it, how do you wash it. We had to install the first clean room in the industry, because tiny amounts of sodium had a tremendous effect on linkage between very tiny lines that were tenths of mils apart.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to develop pure water. I had to work with the water people. And deionized water wasn't good enough. We had to get water that was like... We developed the water that was so pure that the particular young PhD who did this wasn't in his room one day when I brought two visitors in and explained what was going on in there. And the next day, I called him to say... And before I could get very far, he said, "Yeah, I can tell you and two other people were in my laboratory yesterday." "How could you tell?" "Well, you're all breathing out carbon dioxide. Carbonic acid was forming in my water and it registered on my meters." That's how pure that water was. He said, "He could tell me how many people were." This is a guy who invented that duck that dips in the water and goes up and down. He invented that. Never made a nickel of it. He sold it to some toy company who made a mint of it. Miles Sullivan, I still remember him.
Miles?
Sullivan.
Sullivan. Mm-hmm. So the Electrochemical Society would be where this all this sort of stuff was then being published, this process.
Yeah, the stuff that was mostly electrochemical in nature. And, you know, I really didn't appreciate it. And as older I get, I think about it. Electrochemistry is a part of chemistry that the usual inorganic chemical group has it over in some sidebar. You know, not but. But if you think about it today, with the tremendous plant we have around the country and bridges and highways, a little bit of electrochemistry with a little bit of electronics engineering generate DC currents, feed them in back. You could prevent corrosion of all this stuff that has to rust, be scraped and painted, and then finally replaced with electrochemistry. I tried to sell this idea to a man who was on the Federal Commission on Bridges. And he was politely polite about the thing, but he wasn't going to recommend any large effort spending money to develop these techniques. But you see, small electrochemical circuits are generated. That's called corrosion.
Yeah.
And if you can buck it by putting it in another thing, you can do that with photocells and some circuitry, no moving parts.
Yeah.
But somebody has to develop this industry. It's still laying there, undeveloped.
Yeah.
That's just one example.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure there are tremendous examples of electrochemistry in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
With microcurrents, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure that, you know, 50 years from now, we're going to have replacement parts in the way of chips in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Somebody has to do this, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to tell you that, you know, I didn't wave a flag saying, you know, I'm the guy who put this into the Electrochemical Society and they organized a division and it's going very well. I dropped out because I'd solved my problem. I had found an outlet for my people.
Yeah. Were you actually engaged in the organization of the division in the Electrochemical Society or not?
No.
No.
After I found myself wandering around the hall and not getting involved, I figured I'd done my job.
Yeah.
Just as I did with ASTM.
Yeah.
I'd done my job and got on to other things.
Yeah.
I had more problems to solve than I had time, so I had no time for the luxury of getting associated with the society and getting to be its vice president or president and going to meetings and giving talks. That wasn't my job. I had, back home at the Bell Laboratories, I had things to sell. I was being promoted. I became a department head and I became a director. By the time I retired, I had 400 people working in, Murray Hill, Homedale, Whippany, Allentown, Reading, Boston, Cincinnati, Kansas City. That's where I had people. I spent my last 5 or 10 years in an airplane running around deep, talking to people, listening to what they were doing, and coming back home and trying to sell my management for money and support and things of this sort. I was a manager, technical manager.
Yeah,
yeah. Hiring people, firing people where necessary, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dennis, for example, Dennis Turner, he was more or less of a fundamental chemist when I met him. I brought him over and put him into this applied chemical group that I called it. And I gave him the job to design in these little tiny plugs that go into the back of the telephone. You've seen those?
Mm-hmm.
They're little gold-plated wires.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Electric Company decided they didn't know about gold-plating. And this was being made in some place out in Idaho. They had 7 subcontractors they had gone through who couldn't produce a plated spring wire that didn't have holes in the plating so it corroded. Didn't meet the Bell Lab specification, which was if we did it in a lab, we produced gold without pores in it, without holes in it. So the substrate metal, which was a spring wire, didn't corrode and come through and oxidize and become an insulator instead of a connector. Well, I told Dennis, why don't you build a machine? I'll get you the money that you can make this to meet all their requirements. They don't have to go out for 6 subcontractors. They can do it all themselves. The last thing I did before I retired, Dennis delivered this machine to a Western Electric plant in Idaho, and the manager called me up. He says, I know you're retired, but I want to say this is the first machine we ever bought from anybody that worked after we plugged it in. As far as I know, the machine is still running. Dennis had never done anything like this before. He had to build all the facility, and he applied his mind as a scientist to it. He not only built the machinery in its physical form, but he also built the techniques for analyzing all the solutions and adding to it whatever it needed, anything to be added to it. And I had a whole bunch of circuits in a cabinet that stood 6 feet high. It's a great job.
Mm-hmm.
It never would have been done by a chemist all alone in a laboratory.
Yeah, yeah.
He has to have circuit designers help him. I had all those people, you see, in various parts of my organization.
Yeah. How your own career went on, the transistor was how central to your career?
Well, it was everything, as a matter of fact. It sort of pushed everything aside, especially in its early days when their reliability was at very low ebb. And it was because of these, I had to persuade these hard-headed electrical engineers that this was because of contamination was getting in. You were getting leaking fast. You needed to wash these things in very pure water as a last step. And you had to put them together in rooms that didn't have a million particles per cubic foot, like this room here. I bet it's 2 million particles right there. You don't see it. I had a young engineer working for me that I borrowed from Sandia. We had to run the Sandia labs for the government. I brought him into Murray Hill and supported him. And he's the fellow who developed the HEPA filters that allowed us to filter this air. I can't even remember his name because he went back. I'll tell you what happened. We were subcontracting, or Sandia was subcontracting, to build the can't think of the name of the gear. Was it the navigational gear used by the Air Force and the Navy in some place up in Syracuse, New York, I think it was. Yeah. And they had learned up there that they had to scrub all these particles out of the air, and people had to suit up and let the clothes, you know, see them in, because the dirtiest thing in a room was a person, you know. And this young fella worked with one of the, his idea was we would outfit a couple of large moving trucks with benches and filters and fans to bring air in and clean them and bring water up from the tanks that we had and purify them. So when we got contractor A, who might only last for a year, we'd take this moving van up to his place and move it up the back of his plant, open up a door, and he ran it. When the contract was over, we shut the door, got a truck up, and we hauled it away, that van to the succeeding contractor. We didn't have to wait for him to build new rooms all the time and teach him all the experience.
Mm-hmm.
We moved it with a job, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, I thought it was a good idea, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I used that in a hospital there. In deep hip surgery, the amount, you know, it's about a 6-hour job. In these dirty rooms with these surgeons spitting in the wounds, because they have masks on, but they're sodden, you know. I went over to England, where one of our licensees was there. I had talked to them 5 years earlier about HEPA filters. One of the people I talked to had a brother who was a surgeon in hip surgery, and he had installed these in England. By the way, the surgeons in England are dressed as Mr., mm-hmm. not a doctor. And he had reduced the rate of having to reopen them because of problems with the raw materials that had gotten in from the air, down from 7% down to 2.5%. So I sent a surgeon over from New Jersey to find out what he was doing. Paid his way. He came back. And I said, well, we're going to put a room like that in here. And he said, no, I'm the head man of this department. I said, you don't realize I'm the chief executive officer of this hospital. You're going to do what I tell you. I put in a HEPA filter room in Orange, New Jersey. And I put them in gowns with a umbilical cord on the back, so we brought air conditioned air in and took it out. And they didn't sweat, didn't have to spit, you know, masks on. We put X's on the floor where they were allowed to stand, because they couldn't have the air washing over them, because they were the dirtiest things in the room, even with this, with all this equipment on. And we got the same, down something down 3%. It was from 12% to 3%.
Mm-hmm.
When I went out of office 4 years later, you know, they closed that room. This guy was still there. He was going to have some non-physician tell him what to do. Would you believe that? Terrible. I guess it's hard to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I had sent people from the Bell Labs down there to help them design this room and to advise them what to buy and things of this sort. You know, I was always doing five things at one time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
While I was running a baseball team or being the mayor of the town and things of this sort, you know. So I had a sort of a fractured existence, running from one thing to the next and not getting any understanding of things except what people told me. I had to depend on them, see? I couldn't do it with my own hands. These weren't my own numbers, you know. They were their numbers, you know. And I had to depend on people. So I was careful to hire what I thought were good people. And some of them are still there. As a matter of fact, the last guy I hired, I found out that, see if I can get his picture here. This is, you know, the Bell Labs is being broken up into two pieces now.
Yeah.
And see if I picked out the right one. Yeah, here he is. Joe Abbott, Technical Manager, Electroplating Development, Advanced Lightwave Products, Research Marie Hill, was awarded the D. Gardner Folk Memorial Award by the Metropolitan New York Section of the Electrochemical Society.
Hmm.
He was the last guy on earth.
Very good.
PhD. I don't know what he did to this particular one. Yeah.
When you look at transistor development over time, how important was the Electrochemical Society as a forum for discussion
well,
development? Was it the most important place?
As I understand it, first of all, it depends important to who.
Yeah.
It was certainly important to the people doing the work. They were published in a journal that their peers would read.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a physics society journal that their peers didn't even know about. That was an important thing to them. Obviously, these were key techniques, and they're still used today. And as a matter of fact, these techniques are what limits the absolute growth to finer and finer dimensions. They're thinking of getting down into the angstrom area and try to do the thing. I'll admit to you that I was preaching for the last 5 years there. We're going to try to get all the wet chemistry out of transistor processing. Do it all in gases,
mm-hmm.
ionized gases, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who made the transistors, especially in the factories, they love that, because the cost of these chemicals. Now, for example, I was on the committee at Bell Labs on the environment, and the last thing I did before I retired, I shoved across a requirement that manufacturing engineers have to include in their cost of product the cost of protecting the environment from the outfall of their products. Like, for example, hydrochloric acid used in the Allentown plant by the ton was bought by overhead, like they buy water. It wasn't assigned to any particular product. This time when a fellow put in an etching process that required hydrochloric acid, he not only paid for the acid, but he paid to neutralize the acid. And they weren't very happy with it. But it's the only honest way to do it.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how much the hydrochloric acid dropped down in use. They found other things that worked just as well, that didn't have the problem of reclaiming them or neutralizing them. That's when gases began to make their presence felt. Take a gas and ionize it. It's very clean. And it can etch real fast. And you don't have to worry about liquids. You don't have to worry about people breathing, because all this is inside glass chambers. And you see, you take all these roads. You've got to be careful not to have too much loyalty to one group, because you might find yourself, as you understand it, that you have to obsolesce that group and get over in another with another technology.
Yeah.
You've got to have new people looking in to find out what's wrong with what you're doing today. What would be a better way to do it? That was my constant source of preaching, you know, to stimulate you. Don't sit back and say you know how to do it. Not good enough. You know how to do it better and cheaper and more reliable, more effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my role. You can see it's an oddball. I was an oddball to start with in this organization. But I flitted around amongst these things, and I did very well for myself and the people involved. Batteries. No, I was involved in fuel cells. You familiar with fuel cells?
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the landing on the moon, they had to, they were going to rely on fuel cells. And we had a bunch of people down in Washington consulting with NASA. And Ian Ross was down there. He was president of this subgroup. He finally came back to Bell Labs, and he was my boss at that time. He called me from Washington and said, "We don't know whether we can do the moon job because we're not sure the fuel cells are going to work. We have three subcontractors, and we get all kind of mixed signals. We may have to scrub it. Would you get a committee together of senior people, go out and talk to these three suppliers, and let us know what you think?" I did this, and because we had a very short fuse on this, we had to do this all in about 2-3 weeks. We made a recommendation, and I'll show you in the history what they said about that. I think I have it here. This is a book on the history of engineering and science of the Bell system. This is what it says here. Let me see. Bell Labs on occasion assisted in valuing the state of technical developments. For example, both the Gemini and Apollo programs, internal power, the spacecraft was supplied by fuel cells utilizing gases, hydrogen, and oxygen. Relatively new and unproven technology. By mid-1963, there was concern that none of the three commercial contractors carrying out the development would come through in time, thus seriously delaying flight schedules. Three specialists from Bell Labs, myself, Bruce Hannay, who later became a vice president, Upton Thomas, who was an old Electrochemical Society guy from day one. I think he was born in the society. He was always at Electrochemicals, was in it. And it says here, agreed to survey the different developments related to concluded. In late 63, they reported favorably on the prospect for success on one of them. That isn't in here. They were, as it turned out, correct. How's that? That means I didn't believe it. here's Ian Ross. Here's my boy. We were working on it. Oh, by the way, here was the thing on, while they disclaimed any credit for the Manhattan Project here, it says here, samples of the Bell Labs material were being checked weekly by test labs at Columbia and Kellogg. The process was due primarily to FJ Biondi, with contribution later by Ed Tolman. And it says here, more than 36 years later, the Bell Lab process is still the process chosen for fabricating the long-life, reliable barrier material, not only at Oak Ridge, but also at Paducah, Kentucky, and Portsmouth, in the Hoyle plant, and also at the Savannah River plant. That is a gold process. Of course, there are newer ways of doing it now, centrifuges and things of this sort we couldn't use because we didn't have alloys strong enough to take the high. Yeah, here it is. I told how I got involved here, you know, with that Bell Labs experimental work with the Manhattan Bridge Party began in an oblique way early in 1939, blah, blah, blah. Shockley and Nix were studying order-disorder phenomena, where many Bell Labs staff members were pursuing graduate degrees. Under Bell Labs sponsorship, a fertile team of physicists, including Fermi, Dunning, and Pegram, involved experiments in neutron collisions. In the Columbia Chemistry Department, H.C. Urey had concentrated deuterium. He was a heavy water guy. Shockley and Nix visited Columbia to seek advice in the use of neutrons in their order-disorder studies. At that time, 1939, they learned of early experiments of U-235. On it goes. It says here that Nix formed a small group, including Don McNair, George Clement Larson. He was the only member of staff. Then I came in, and I didn't want to go to New Jersey, and he left.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on to talk, talks about the mixtures of helium and carbon dioxide. This is the only history there is that I can find anywhere where Bell Labs did today.
Yes, that's the history of the engineering of science in the Bell system, and you're just reading from pages 348 and 9, which has a pretty good account.
Yeah, I don't know whether you can get this in a public library.
Yes, I think we have
a copy of that,
it was published in 78.
So there it is.
Very good. You mentioned Bruce Hannay, and did your and his paths overlap a lot? I guess they must have done.
Yeah, well, Bruce, when he first came to Bell Labs, he was in a group with that was studying the corrosivity of the barrier that I had developed.
Excuse me, would you like a glass of iced tea?
That would be very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, we were worried about would it plug. Nickel is not supposed to plug, but you don't. Not supposed to, so you actually make tests. So he was running these tests out at Murray Hill. And much later, many years later, he's a fellow named Coleman, who also was an electrochemist. He was a real scientist. Both these fellows were trained as scientists. And he, you know, Bruce Hannay brought the first mass spectrometer into the Bell Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And guess where he put it? He put it in a room next to where I had an office, where I was doing this secret work, had to bring people through it. And in the room on this side, there were three women with geodetic survey maps. They were laying out a horizon-to-horizon hilltop survey from Manhattan to Boston for the first microwave links. Later on, the first tube they used in that system was this one here, the 416 microwave amplifier.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first transistor here, the first 1,000-bit memory. You know, as I said, I had five or six groups. This I got from my Allentown group. This.
I like your weak points.
Well, this is a 416 microwave amplifier. This is a traveling way to a microwave amplifier, also used in many of the government people. Now, this is a nickel cadmium tube, a nickel cadmium battery, which has a life of 10 years compared to the normal life, which is like 3 years, that they used in the Moon Project. You notice they had ceramic seals rather than plastic seals. That's hermetically sealed. They could be like a tube is. You know. This is the first transistor, which is a point contact on germanium. This is the first amplifier tube buried in the transatlantic cable. This is some of my early activity in creosoting wood. That only lasted a year in that job. I discovered penicillin on that job. A year before it was announced by a doctor in Canada, he discovered it the same way I did. I was trying to keep successive generations of various fungi alive. And I was losing 20% of my samples. And I looked in the petri dishes and I could see little dots. And I went to the man and said, hey, this is something is so powerful here that a fungus that would dissolve, eat up a cubic centimeter of wood in a week is killed. They said, look, we're in a trouble, but never mind that medical stuff. And a year later, Sir Arthur Fleming, he was knighted by the Queen. He was the Queen or the King at that time, 1937.
He was the King, Alexander Fleming.
Yeah. You know him, do you?
No, I don't, but I know about his work,
yeah.
Yes.
He was a Nobelist.
Yes.
I wrote him a letter, told him how I discovered it. He wrote back, and he was very nice. He wrote back and said he discovered it the very same way. Too bad your people didn't pay any attention to you. But I didn't last very long in that job, because this people in this lab were on the metric system. They used cubic centimeters of wood, and they told it how many grams of impregnate they put in, and then they had to transfer all this knowledge to an engineering group down in Louisiana, where they pumped creosote in and stuff like that. And they were engineers, they wanted no pounds per. So the first job I had was to sit down at a machine with a handle and multiply these numbers by some other number to get it from grams per cubic centimeter to pounds per cubic foot.
Yes, yes.
And I worked the thing backwards and found out that something was wrong. This. Mm-hmm. Look at that book, get out of it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If it's not sweet enough, let me know. I brew my own tea and I make it strong.
That's good.
My maternal grandmother was English.
Wow. Okay.
Brewing
well,
tea was a
an important activity.
Life.
Yes.
Well, I went into the show me your calculations. So I did. He finally had to agree I was right. So he figured I'm not going to last very long in this department. I've stayed the boss, you know.
Yes. Yes.
He was R.R. Williams' son-in-law. R.R. Williams was the guy who synthesized vitamin B1. Those are great days, I tell you. But you imagine turning something down and it turned out to be penicillin?
That's quite something.
There was a bunch of biochemists at Rutgers University at that time who we could have gone to. They did much of the early development work.
Yeah. And tell me about R.M. Burns, if you would. And can you just talk about him?
Well, I had very little contact with him except in the hiring stage. Harvey Neville says, why don't you hire this young man if you want to replace him? We'll find somebody else to take his place out here on the faculty. And then I came in and he assigned me to go out and work at Summit, New Jersey, which was 30 miles out. And I lost touch with R.M. Burns. The next time I got involved with him was I met him at a dinner. This was a dinner in 1946 at the Waldorf Astoria, where the Chemical Engineering Achievement Award dinner went to the Atom Bomb Project. He was at table 32 with me. In fact, we met at his house ahead of time, and here's a copy of Burns. He's at table 32.
Yeah.
And here was I, table 32.
See? Okay, and then this is the Chemical Engineering
Achievement Award dinner to the Atom Bomb Project in 1946.
The other guy at table 32 was Bill Shockley. At that time he had invented the transistor. And this is very well done, by the way, for a historian type person here. I've dragged that around from one house to another in a little old box, you know. And it gives a good review of the program, the whole thing. This and all the people who are involved in it.
Yes, I must say, I don't know if you've given any thought to the eventual disposition of chemical mementos like that, but we would certainly covet them.
Okay, well, that's a good thought. Otherwise, you throw it out, you know?
Yeah, well, our business is, among other things, to physically conserve these evocative pieces of the chemical heritage, because
I tell you, it's such a throbbing organization that it keeps changing. You know, it's like, you know, that was the Hydra. You cut an arm off and it grows another one, you know, somewhere else.
Oh yes.
And people get stuck on the arms that get cut off, you know, by staying with them instead of moving with the whole thing. I was in a privileged position. I didn't have any established history in any one area. I could move around and do what I wanted to do and then move again to another area.
Yes, yeah. Well, you
that was the thing. That was my thing.
Well, you exploited your liberty very very wonderfully.
You see, in Europe, my father's family divided into two groups. One group's in Siena, and they're all physicians. In fact, I went down a country road there one time at the top, and I saw the back of a bust. I went around looking in front. It was my name, exactly. Frank Joseph Vialli. He was the chief surgeon of the local hospital, member of the faculty of the schooled, and he was looking down his valley. He was buried on top of a hill you could see for 40 miles on a clear day, and lots of clear days there. And the other part of the family's up around Pisa and Lucca. And they're in the electrical business, electrical engineering. My father was the oddball, and he wanted to study music.
and he came over here because he found out that there was more music sold in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania than any other part of the world. Sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't last very long because he found out that music teachers in this country aren't paid very well. So he went to Penn State. He got a degree in mechanical engineering.
Hmm.
He brought his brother over. He got electrical engineering. And then here is the... This is the wine down around Siena, beyond the Santee.
Oh,
this sells for $150 a liter.
Mm-hmm.
10 years old before it's bottled. It's a Brunello. And when the president of Italy went to England, he had the queen over to the embassy for a dinner, and this is the wine he took.
So,
I have that menu. Would you believe that?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
We had five or six bottles of this, and this is from the New York Times here.
This is in 21 February 85, talking about while Biondi Santi is unquestionably the greatest name in Brunello's. Boy. So it, you really missed your vocation.
You better stay there, right? Here's the prices here. From New York Times, May 1, 1994. Brunello di Montalcino.
Biondi Santi, $99 for what is that? Is that for a, what's that for? For a bottle?
That's for a liter.
For a liter?
Yeah.
Right, yes. Okay.
Beautiful.
So that's really the where the family comes from in its deeper origins.
Yeah.
Yes.
We had four bottles.
Mm.
1972, I think that was. Yeah.
Mm. Well, how do you see?
I'm sorry to be so disconnected here, but
this is just fine. This is just fine. How do you see the if you gaze into the crystal ball of the future? Is the transistor type, the solid state type activity, is there going to be lots and lots more of that will be still under the electrochemical heading?
Yeah, it's very difficult to predict because, as I say, they're getting rid of aqueous processing acids, alkalis, because first of all, their problems with people, their problems with the atmosphere, they're going more and more towards working inside of glass chambers with ionized materials, which where you can make a pound do or a ton would do with the aqueous materials.
Mm.
That's the way they're going to go. And it's clean. You can clean it. You can check it out before you use it. Clean air. Cleans. As a matter of fact, one simple thing that I did to one factory to increase one of the West African factories was I put a wall up, and everything that was delivered to that building, and that was one wall of it, was on the outside. That's where they brought in the carboys, and they connected them up and all that before they bring them into the room where they made these things. With all the dirt.
Yeah.
And put all that outside, you put it into the pipe. And even the furnace, when the furnaces would burn up, and you had to take them out with all the insulation, I backed them up against the wall, had doors in the wall with tracks. You just roll them out, close the door, and it's fixed out there. When it's fixed, open the door and bring it back in again. Mm. It makes just common sense, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Automobiles are done the same way. Work on an automobile.
Yes.
You take it to where the equipment is, you know.
Yes.
You don't repair an automobile in front in the parlor. That's what we were doing. You were repairing ovens in the parlor.
Yes.
And you're surprised that people wouldn't, you know, it takes money to do this, I'll admit. So I put up, in this new building at Murray Hill that they put up, I remember that they hadn't quite approved all the plans, but I got word of the plan that we were going to be on the fifth floor. And I went to the vice president who was in charge of the work that I was doing, a guy named Jack Morton, who was a character, I tell you. He fired me three times, but called me up 2 days later to apologize, you know. We didn't agree on certain things, you know. Like, well, anyway, I had called Jack up one day and said, Jack, you're the guy committed space. I'm going to be on the fifth floor with all my labs. Yep. I'd like to come up and talk to you about it. Okay, how about right now? That's the kind of guy he was right now. And I said, Jack, the average height of these floor to ceiling here is 10 feet. I'd like to have the fifth floor be 14 feet. What the hell do you want that for? I told him, I want to build clean rooms up there and I want to have a floor when it comes up 2 to 3 feet with all the wiring underneath. And I want special walls on the outside where all the stuff comes in, the dirty stuff. And I want a special ceiling and I want to put in HEPA filtered air. Didn't take him 5 minutes. Good idea. And I knew what a competitive guy he was. He wasn't going to agree just that fast. And I said, now you're going to have the cleanest room in the Bell system. Oh, this is better than Allentown has. Mm-hmm. Where his competitors had the manufacturing. You had to etch them on. Bought it right then and there. The builder was fit to be tied. He had all his plans. Because there was two floors above it. He had to move the whole thing up. We finally did that. And later on, they were complaining that this was a gold-plated outfit. You know, nobody could get in it. We didn't allow visitors. This is not a place for visitors to go in. They could look through the glass. Wanted to go inside, they had to get my personal signature, and they had to get dressed for it. You know, and they thought we had a gold-plated outfit. And I said, we have to have gold-plated treatment in order to make platinum-treated parts. You know, and by that's how we got reliability. We didn't change anything in a solid. We changed it in the atmosphere around it.
Yes.
Got rid of the sodium ions, for example. Got rid of the dust particles. Yes. Made a big deal. That particular little tube that was used in the towers, microwave towers, they had a flat cathode, like a pill, and they had a grid over it. Tungsten wire, 0.7 mil above it. And that wire was so tiny that it broke at 14 grams. So we had to wind that on a machine on a piece of tungsten with a hole in it, a flat sheet with a hole in it. Mm-hmm. So the machine, the wire was up there one time, then it went down there. And we had to do it without breaking that 14 mil. 14 milligrams.
Yes.
Wait.
Yeah.
Very tight. And that was 0.7 mil away. And then above that was the anode. And the whole thing could be plugged in. You put a plug on it. It'll plug from one side for the other, you see. But that made possible coast-to-coast television, too. Mm-hmm. We originally did it for coast-to-coast communications.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not telling it.
Yes.
Then, you know, we put up the first satellite before the U.S. government got one up. We had Telstar 1 went up.
Yes.
Nobody in it.
Yeah.
And it only lasted 4 days because 3 days after it went up, the Army exploded an atom bomb right in the path of the damn thing. Not that they were trying to destroy it. They had planned that, but they didn't tell anybody. Would you believe that? After all that work, private satellite, we lost it.
Yeah.
they creamed our, what it did was they creamed all the semiconductors. So that, we said we got a new challenge. We got to develop semiconductors that will stand that kind of, and we did. So the present satellites come take advantage of that information. Now, just where the, no question in my mind that the electrochemical society played a key role at a time when it was necessary to play that particular card, and they provided this. What happened to it? I'm sorry to say I can't tell, because I didn't stay with it.
Yeah.
Not because I wasn't interested, because I had other things to do with it.
Yeah.
I went on patch here, and patch there, and patch somewhere else. And the whole thing worked, you see.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, you did. You were a key benefactor.
That's right.
Their results were.
That's right. I didn't drop that atom bomb. In fact, I was surprised they dropped the damn thing. I thought they were tested in a more humane way. But, you know, they had Harry Truman down there, who was a tough old bird.
Yeah.
And we had a bunch of tough guys in the Army Air Corps who wanted, they said, you know, million of ours versus this atom bomb, million of theirs, you know. They won't understand it. And they didn't understand it even after it was dropped, you know. They thought they could sweat it out, you know.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Tremendous business. Boy, that business about the atom bomb. We bring guys in, you know. Norway was occupied by the Germans, and Sweden was not. Norway and what's the other?
Denmark.
Denmark. We wanted to bring in a professor from Denmark. You know, we got the ROSS people went in, took him out, put him on a plane, brought him over to New York. We talked to him for 4 hours, put him back on a plane, sent him back, and reinserted him. They would do that all the time. They said, no problem. You would see him, just let us know. I still remember that name.
That was in connection with the atom bomb?
That's right, yeah. We could only talk to him in one room that our Secret Service people had checked out. Wasn't bugged, they said, you know. Because we had so much trouble with the Japanese after the war coming over here. Although we were taking pictures of everything, we had a room, we'd take them through, that would fog all the pictures. They never complained. They either understood why and said, oh, well, okay, makes sense. We was trying to steal your idea, and you know how to protect yourself. They never. To my knowledge.
Yes, yes, yes. How have the well, the recent the changes with AT&T and since 84 and now this new thing, how have they affected the Bell Labs' role and capability in these areas?
Well, they're back to where they were in 1926 when they put it all together. That's when they had AT&T was running mostly the telephone companies, all the operating companies. They were the headmaster of all those people. And they owned the Western Electric Company, who was a manufacturer. And they decided to put them together. And I told you, with some of the hard times we had to wait for a generation of people to retire before that became smooth, because the old flags were still flying, you know. Now they're back to where they were again. AT&T is running, they don't run the telephone companies anymore because they haven't got them. They run the long distance telephone system. They're not going to be allowed by law to get into the local into the same local service. That's going to take 10 years, but they'll get into it. And they're also going to get into cable TV, anything they can get into now. And they're going to start an AT&T laboratory. And to do that, they took about 50% of the old Bell laboratories. The other 50% they left behind, they still call the Bell Laboratories. It works now for the organization, which is used to be Western Electric, which makes switching equipment, and all kinds of things. You see, the baby Bills wouldn't buy switching equipment from the old Western Electric Company after they were separated, because they knew that AT&T was going to be their competitor. Why should they buy and make a profit for their competitor? So now, by even changing the name to Lucent, there's no hint of Bell System involved in that second company.
Yeah.
I think it'll flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because all these other companies start buying switching equipment from the Canadians or from the Germans. Because they didn't want to give a profit to AT&T. And AT&T's profits from switching equipment was going downhill. Mm-hmm. These are big... That's what these things were developed for, these big cards.
Yes, yes.
And there's gold-plated contacts on the edge of that. That's very important. There was a lot of problem with that. That whole switching system, which can handle something like 500,000 calls during a busy hour, works on the basis of all the circuitry being plugged in. Everything goes through those gold-plated prongs at the end,
mm-hmm.
here and there. And that thing checks itself out every 3 minutes and tells the operators what's wrong and what to do about it. Self-diagnosed, part of the system. And all that equipment is all based on circuit boards, glass circuit boards, or copper circuit boards with something with seven layers, where you go down to layer two to get power and up to layer three to get conductivity this way or that way. Mm-hmm. And that's called the Electronic Switching System, ESS. That was developed 20 years ago now. Yeah, maybe 25. I was involved in that, in the gold plating end of it, because they were saying, God, all these beautiful circuits we have, if the connectors don't work, we've lost the whole thing.
Yeah.
You got to be able to pull them out and shove another one in. And it's working. And it was the premier switch anywhere in the world. They licensed people to make them. They've licensed the Chinese to make them. Yeah, I presume they're going to get some money from the license, but not a very profitable thing. But I think the Electrochemical Society is going to continue to have a role in the electronics business. I think, like any society or any organization, it ought to be smart enough to look out in the new areas. I mentioned some of them very briefly. I don't know if anybody's doing anything about it. I don't read anything about it anywhere.
The new areas like...
corrosion resistance.
Yes.
No, there's utterly billions and billions of rusting away bridges. Sidewalks. Down in Philadelphia, there was a bridge put in on a Schuylkill Parkway, isn't it? Is that what it's called? And it would have lasted 2 years because the steel rods in them began to corrode. Some or other,
yes,
water got in cracks or something, and salt from the,
yes,
you know, for the ice. Now, you know, a little generator, it's used on pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the gas pipelines take gas out of the pipelines to generate power with some thermocouples. You know, dissimilar metals, you warm them up, yeah, a little bit, you generate current. Yeah. And a bird on there. Sorry. I'm following a bird who's emptying his bowels on our driveway. I'm trying to find out where the hell he lives. So I think he's in there. Anyway, that would be a tremendous area to work on. I don't know why there isn't more attention paid to that.
Yes. The Electrochemical Society seems to have been unusual, perhaps, or in having being very open to all these applied
really?
Areas and issues.
How about cross-bleeding with or blending with the American Chemical Society. Does the Electrochemical Society get involved in them? No joint meetings?
No, they've really kept themselves pretty pretty distinct. Some of the same people turn up wearing a different hat.
Sure.
But
you know, there's all kind. There are societies that deal with a phenomenon only, or with a material only, or a process only, way down at the bottom. And you have specialists in that area. Then at the other end, you have the monoliths, like IEEE and American Chemical Society.
Yeah.
You know, deal with everything. If you go to a meeting, you get lost in the mush.
Yeah.
Tremendous. And then in between, there's all kind of gradations. And some of these societies maybe no longer have any real reason to take the spot they had 20 years ago. They don't longer have it. They're not entitled to it.
Yeah.
Techniques moves along. Something moves along. That's the danger when you work on something that is helpful to the electronics industry, which moves all the time.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's the price you have to pay. You'll be left behind them. Either because you're obsolete, or maybe you lost interest, or maybe it's in the new activities involve techniques or science that is way away from your province.
Yeah. Well, they seem to, the Electrochemical Society seems to have stayed with it.
How is its members showing? Is it increasing? Holding its own?
It's holding its own. It's been increasing, I think, with overseas membership, and that globalization phenomenon is what's happening, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the society thinks of you as one of its benefactors for bringing the solid state.
Let me say honestly, I didn't do this with the idea in mind that I like this society, I'm going to help them. They were in a position they could help me. Yeah. I needed an outlet for my people to publish their work, and I couldn't find it. It was going to be scattered. Mm. It was going to be published in 8 different places, which is even worse. So I thought if I could centralize it in one place, for most of the people, you can't guarantee this thing. After all, I was not a dictator. I couldn't say you have to publish there. I got most of them to do that. You know, I didn't have to take much pressure to do that. Yeah. But this must have, you know, there must be dozens of guys around like me that worked on these other societies, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well,
I don't know who they are. They don't know who I am, you see?
Yeah.
We meet in the middle.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you were the one who made this thing stick.
I threw the crystallized it by throwing something into the, and then went away. And whoever took it over and kept it running did a job.
Yes. Well, you scratched the test tube.
The ASTM is still in existence.
Oh yes,
right. But there are other societies around that are doing the same sorts of things.
Yes, there's competition.
And they had such an antiquated structure, you know. They were worried about glass windows and railroad tracks and big industry items like that, you know, and pipes. Well, every time I pick up a polyvinyl chloride pipe around here in my irrigation system, it says ASTM on it. So-and-so, committee so-and-so. Believe it, I picked a piece up yesterday. I just looked at it. There she is, she's still operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, no, that's still very much in business.
But I used to go to some of the meetings of their board and on Saturdays, so it wouldn't cut into my work week, especially in the wintertime when I didn't have to work. Didn't have baseball considerations and things like that. And I didn't even know what they were talking about, you know. Little problems come up that are different in each area of specialization. And you have to have a history of that to understand what the problem was.
Yeah.
And nobody stopped to say, look, there's a new man in the room. They better say, you know, X years ago we were doing this and this and this happened, and now we're doing it this way, and we're having a problem here. That's where we are today. Then they go on, I understand. They never did that. I didn't expect them to do it. I was sort of hanging on, trying to understand it. In fact, I did put a man on their board. I found a man who was interested in that kind of thing. Got him on their board. He turned out later to be a vice president of AT&T. I lost track of the guy.
Well, you've had a good talent for
spotting
winners.
He was a guy when he was the vice president of Western Electric Company. For saw a tremendous growth about to occur, and we had to go out and buy property in 8 or 10 states. You know, Alabama, Wisconsin, Washington, for a future plan. In fact, start to work on the one in Los Angeles. Then the bottom fell out of the market. We were stuck with all these properties. In some cases, we had half-finished buildings. Boy, was he wrong. You know, we didn't have that growth. You know, they were talking 7 or 8% a year, which is fantastic. You know, we're 1.5% now.
Yes.
Fantastic. And then he also did some smart things. Anytime we wanted to start anything new, we had to do an analysis of the break-even point. How much would it cost us to get into this business? How long would it take? And what would we get out of it? For example, when I got involved in batteries, the Bell system, you know, the operating companies work on DC. I don't know if you know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They buy AC, rectify it, and then trickle charge batteries, and then operate the plant off batteries. This gives them, in case there's a drop-off of the AC, they can operate for, depending on how many hours a place is designed for, anywhere from 1 to 14, 15 hours. Or some plants put in a diesel engine in addition to run an alternator, which then is rectified. Well, we were having trouble buying batteries that we could depend on. They became vintage things. Batteries made in a certain year, in a certain plant, on the second shift, but not the third shift, were better than those made on the first shift. It was terrible. One battery went bad, you couldn't put a new battery in on the whole string. You know, place was terrible. And we found out all we knew about batteries, big batteries, was what the battery companies told us. And I said to my boss, why don't we believe in these guys? They don't have any evidence that they understand this thing. Why don't we take that understanding over? We'll run our own show. We'll design our own battery. He says, come on. That battery business is in there. Been in dentists for 100 years. You're going to beat them out? I says, I think we can get a better battery out of it if we design it ourselves. Forget about these guys. We sat down, closed the door one day, up to the book. Problem number one. We decided we'd put modern science into every aspect of it. All right, we're going to use lead. Why don't they use lead? Because it expands as it oxidizes. And the guts, which gives the electrochemical activity, falls out. So that's because they use lead alloys. And why do they use lead alloys, lead anode? Because lead is too soft. If you make it vertical, it flows like butter, but at a much slower rate. It takes years. But it flows enough that these little fillings drop out of the holes in it. They're actually square holes. So we said, well, we'll use pure lead. Well, avoid that. How do you do that? Well, you got to lay it flat. Well, you can't lay it flat. So we decided to lay it at 10 degrees, and we built a stack of pancakes at 10 degrees and put a hole up the middle so we could pump the sulfuric acid around. Otherwise, it would stabilize. It would have a gravity much different down here than it had up here. And these are big cells, you know, they're that tall. same things used in submarines. That we helped the Navy design their submarines so many, many years ago. Anyway, so we started on that premise, and we were able to go out in the field and take batteries that were, for some reason, 20 years old. They had lasted. Surprising. Brought them in, took them apart, and found out how did they look like when they were 20 years old? And why didn't they expand? So we decided to make a tester up. Well, in the long run, before we knew it, in 2 years, we were able to take a new idea and put it in a test battery and get 20 years of experience in 2 years. So we had a handle. We could then make changes, put it through this test, and we redesigned these cells. They're called the round cells now. And then our manager said, we're not in the battery business. We're going to take this out and have the battery people make them. I said, you mean these old guys that gave us these lousy batteries, you're going to let them make our battery? Come on. Don't believe you. And he says, well, you can't make that battery that you're talking about unless you have guys in white coats with PhDs. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll rent some space from our junkyard. We had a junkyard in Staten Island. What the hell was it called? Well, anyway, doesn't matter. I went down and rented some space from them and put up, they had earthen floors in this building. She was how old it is. I put a building up inside the plant for their offices, and we made the batteries outside, and we put them into this test that we had, and then we put them in a one exchange, and finally he was convinced, hell, if you can build them down there in the junkyard on an earthen floor, these battery guys can't be so bad. He was still wrong. We had to nurse these battery guys. We had to pay them to make our batteries because of his idea. And it turned out, 20 years later, that battery that we're selling all over the world is making more money for AT&T than the transistor business. Would you believe that?
Boy.
Beautiful. I had an exhibit on it then to throw them all out because they were big plates, you know. In fact, I had the guys made me a lamp with an old battery. You know, my wife said, that's out, you know. Couldn't bring her in the house. But, you know, that led never. See, in the meantime, we had a fallout of this thing. Bill Campbell, this fellow who was sitting at the table with us at the Adam Baum Award, which I chose to sit on my committee on fuel cells, he was working, instead of a lead antimony, which causes all this water to be gassed into hydrogen and oxygen, and therefore you have to add water all the time. He used another, and that was put in there to try to make the lead stronger, more brittle, not flow, when it was based on an up and down like a sheet. So what was it? He added another item to it, which resulted in a no maintenance battery, because it didn't break down water into hydrogen and oxygen. Mm-hmm. And that was it. The whole industry had, you know, that not a single company came to us to buy a license to use that. And the day the patent expired, J.C. Penney called us. Somewhere around the country, they sell batteries in our stores. They wanted to buy know-how, not a license to use a patent to the patent that expired, but how much was the know-how going to cost? So they could use this lead with a vertical plate, but with a new element in it to make it strong, which did not hydrolyze water. At the same time, on the one end, this guy was working to make it a better battery using the old technique. We were working on the other end with a flat plate, relatively flat, 10 degrees. And the idea of the chimney effect, there were different gravities at the top, there was at the bottom, and they tended to equalize it that way. You know, we had 18 different batteries, depending on where you went, to measure the concentration of the sulfuric acid and or its temperature, you see? Mm-hmm. And we didn't use any burning. Lead is traditionally burned with a flame. All the lead contacts are made by diffusion. What you do, you put the two clean parts, you put them together, and you put an RF field around it to heat the part slowly. And by diffusing, there's no oxygen in the part,
mm-hmm.
no oxidized parts. That's where the corrosion used to occur.
Yes.
Spectrochemistry, you see?
Very good.
Yeah. Very the battery good. Business, that's always going to be with us as a battery.
Yes, oh yes.
And I don't know where the guys who were working on the battery business got involved with a committee of the IEEE, which was standardizing batteries. So that's where their outlet was. I got involved in that thing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still involved. Then we decided to start a new society called the Power Society. It deals with power of all sorts, from microwatts to megawatts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still running, and one of my guys is still involved in that. He calls me up every now and then. He sends me programs, and I said, I'm not going to your meetings. I won't understand what you're talking about. It's a waste of my time. You know, I've been out. I've been retired now 12 years or so, yeah. When I left Bell Labs, I became a consultant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I was solving the same problems I'd solved 10 years earlier in the outside industry. And I was amazed at the lack of honesty in most American corporations. They were thieves. They were buying information. They were hiring people only if they brought with them all the information from their former job, including blueprints, specifications. And those working for the government were worse. I was asked to consult on some jobs where they were building connectors. I became an expert in the connector business. It's because I knew something about gold. And I inspired, I couldn't inspire an American company, I inspired a Japanese company to build a piece of equipment you put at the end of a plating line, which measured the plating rate in each cell of a plating line. And if the plating rate had dropped for some reason, it increased it in that cell, or it was too high, it decreased it. And then it tested 100% of the product as it came out. Here they could tell a customer that 100% of what you're buying has been tested, and we know it hadn't got holes in it to corrode to the base. It has low contact resistance because you got the amount of gold there that you want to be there. I couldn't, not it was any American company. I went over to Japan, spent 3 days over there, representing an American company. The only way I could get to these Japanese companies is I had to become a consultant to these Japanese companies for 3 days. And they gave me Japanese printing card, mm-hmm. name mm-hmm. cards. They took me around to all their places. They had an interpreter with me. They had a chauffeur who couldn't speak English, hauled me all around, mostly around Tokyo. And it was a very successful operation. The company who bought it, who I was consulting with, fired the guy I was working with. Because he was the guy for all these years had been telling how good it was. When he bought this equipment from the Japanese and found out how bad the problem was, he was shipping out. He was shipping out two or three times the thickness of gold that he needed to.
Boy.
Because he was afraid it was too thin. He had reports. This machine measured it, you see, to a micron.
Yeah.
You're supposed to put on so many microns of gold, he was putting on double or triple. And when he found out this machine, the cost of the gold that each month dropped to a third, they fired him.
Yeah.
That's one of my problems. Is one company I worked for, three vice presidents were discharged because I was put on a job to find out what was wrong with their program, and I found out. I won't tell you the company name because it's a well-respected company. Yeah. Well respected company. People were afraid to talk to me.
I could imagine.
Yeah. Because I got the reputation, don't talk to that guy, you're going to get you fired. Then, you know, that didn't happen at Bell Labs, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is a very respected company, still in business today, making a lot of money. One of the companies on Long Island was building a connector for a circuit that was going into an Air Corps fighter. When these young kids go up, you know, they crash half of them, you know. And I could understand if they depended on the stuff they put in was 30 years old, these connectors. And they had no... what they did was 30 years earlier in some airplane they were making 30 years ago, they proved that that connector was working properly. That's the way the Air Force works. And they certify you as a supplier of that. You're certified. Every now and then they'll send an inspector around to see if you haven't changed anything. That doesn't happen very often. And what's happening is the 30-year-old product is getting worse and worse because the guy who's manufacturing it is no interested in it. He's got 5 new products, but he can't change because if you do that, they've got to recertify that.
Yeah.
And that takes 2 years. And for 2 years, you can't sell anything to the government. So they don't want to recertify. So they called me out to this place, Long Island, and want to know whether I would work with them to solve their problem so they didn't have to recertify it. They would make some changes. I said, you know you can't do that. That's illegal. And you shouldn't be asking me to do something illegal. I said, just that, and my bill is going to be 3 times my normal rate. And they paid it. And I said, look, if anything comes up here, I have my own records. You can't sue me, you know, because I didn't do it. Help you avoid the law, you know. Trouble with these people, hombre. I had a guy who was plating, this electrochemist, he was plating platinum on a contact that, again, was going to a government agency. And the chief engineer was a bookkeeper. He called me up one day because I had helped him. He ran out of gas on a highway in New Jersey, and I stopped, helped him out get some gas, introduced himself, and I told him I was working for Bell Labs and all that. He called me up one day after I had retired. He said, oh, he didn't hear anymore, but they gave him my number. Called me up and says, we're having a problem. The platinum on our connectors is corroding. So, wait a minute, platinum doesn't corrode. I better keep quiet about this so I find out what's going on. So I went out to visit this plant in suburban New Jersey, and I found out, by God, he was getting corrosion. Couldn't believe it. So I said, look, you got to give me a carte blanche and go anywhere I want around here. I'm going to find out what the hell's going on, or I'm not going to help you. Okay, got carte blanche. A young man who was running a plating bath, and it looked like platinum. Platinum baths are practically transparent. The other guy said, what are you doing in here? You're not allowed. I said, just a minute. Your boss gave me a piece of paper, said I can go anywhere I want. Oh, that bastard, he says. So I left. I said, something's going on here. So I went down to the local library, got the local paper, and I found out that this company had been pouring carbon tetrachloride and plating sluices out the window on the earth, and they had contaminated the wells of about 40 adjacent property owners. And they had been sued, had them put in a water system, and they had been prohibited by the court to any more plating in this life. I didn't tell the guy I was working for about this. Then I went over to a see, they got these things from some place up in Hackensack or something. I went up and visited it, and boy, terrible place, plain bed. The guys were eating our lunch while they're smoking cigars, putting ashes in the plain bed. Couldn't believe it. Anyway, I got back and said, what happens now? Well, we send them over to the machine shop and they check them out to be sure they're thick enough. And then there was a young a kid on a lathe. He put these on a lathe and he checks them out with a gauge. Can't go in, it's too thick. So he puts that particular contact in a lathe and spins it around and he runs a tool against it. Guess what he was doing? He was taking a platinum that they put on. And he wasn't doing it uniformly. The thing wasn't spinning perfectly. It was wobbling a little bit. So he took it off in one place and exposed the stainless steel underneath. And that was rusty. And that's why the bookkeeper thought the platinum was cruel. So I had to go up and get the guy. I said, come on, Don, don't say anything after I show you until we leave. I don't want the kid that's doing this work to be embarrassed. Not his fault. Don, he saw it. And he said, walked out in the hall, said, what was wrong with that? And you didn't notice? He took off quite a bit of the platinum. And some spots have a different color than the platinum. He's taking off and he's leaving a spot there. That's where it corrodes, the stainless steel. I said, by the way, I don't want to be involved with you anymore. You're the third guy I run into in a month who's trying to be illegal. He's going to say that I'm the guy who cleared this up for you. I don't want to be involved in any work. Here's my bill, and goodbye. I didn't cut out the business from you. Because I tried to get liability insurance, couldn't buy it. The American Chemical Society was doing this for a while, but they dropped it because it got too expensive.
Mm.
I tried to work on a contract for Georgia Power on batteries. They wanted liability insurance. I didn't have it, so I couldn't take that. And I worked on one for Commonwealth Edison in New York. They had a big power plant to operate their instruments. Like they had a big solenoid, you know, switch mm-hmm. that operates when there's an overload mm-hmm. on it. And this battery operates that switch. That switch is on the roof. And it's operated only by a union guy. He wouldn't let me see the damn thing. And they took his place. Couldn't see the thing I was supposed to. I wanted to take a look at it, open it up. I didn't know what I was going to find. So I looked at the batteries. And they had contracted with a company to run two little wires to every battery. And they were connected with a telephone system to the boss's home at night. That would tell him about every. The battery was a bunch of individual cells hooked together about as big as this table. And this was a useless kind of thing. They didn't know what the hell the batteries were doing. So I said, look, there's only one thing you can do here. I said, batteries is like the wine business. You have to taste the wine to see if it's any good. All the other tests are worthless. On batteries, testing the potential of one cell doesn't tell you a damn thing. What you have to do is deep discharge these damn things like it's an actual case and see how they behave. Measure each one, but as you deep discharge them, not as you trickle charge them. It's ridiculous. And they said, well, how are you going to do it? Well, I said, the thing you do is you set up a battery central office somewhere where you keep these things charging and you have a bunch of trucks. Maybe four or five trucks, depending on how many you need, with batteries on their backs. You run them up to a place that's having trouble, and you run the wires in the windows. They're all on the first floor since they're very heavy. And you disconnect the big cells that are in there and put your cells on a truck on the line. And you operate, and you take these old cells out of there, and you get new cells. You test them before you put them in, back in battery central. They didn't tell me why they were doing all this, but I found out. They were checking whether the batteries, not whether the batteries, they were checking whether that solenoid was working or not. Once every 3 months, by taking a big cable, about that size, copper cable, with a 2x4 to hold it, over to a steam radiator and make a big arc. That would draw a lot of power, and that thing was supposed to drop out. This solenoid was 8 feet tall, big thing, oil filled or something. I never saw it because the union guy wouldn't let me in there. He thought I was going to take his job away or something. And that's what they'd been ordered by the courts to hire somebody who knew anything about batteries and solve this problem for them, rather than do it by them. They knocked out all of Manhattan from 14th Street down south at 3:30 in the afternoon. I didn't even know about this. And they were very quiet about it. They finally said to me, would you be willing to go up to Albany as a consultant witness and tell them what you propose here, because all the other companies we hired had never thought of this thing. So that's what we do in the telephone company. We discharge them. Who would have found out? You see? Yeah, they maybe put them through a test. And if they're too old, maybe you only get half of the capacity, maybe a quarter or even a less. So I said, well, I tell you, I don't like this idea because I don't like to deal with a bunch of politicians who are talking about technical problems. But I said, if necessary, I'll do it. They never called on me. I said, you tell them who I am, where I came from. I'm an independent consultant now, no longer with Bell Labs. But that's the way you solve your problem. And I never heard back from them. Either they abandon it or they're using it. That's the worst part about being a consultant. You never hear about that.
Yeah.
To your chickens, you know.
Yes.
Whether you hatch them or not, you know.
Yes.
Well.
Okay.
So here I am in West Palm Beach. It's boring. Tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I've thought about getting involved at local universities, but boy, they're politically dominated.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm interested in is their salaries of the teachers and the salary of the chairman of the board. You have a junior college here. My God, the guy's retiring and he's taking something like $700,000 out. It just came out in the newspaper. Another $200,000 that this is all things he arranged while he was chairman of the board.
Right.
There was sick pay, vacation pay. He named two colleges after himself. Oh, I can't believe this. This is the head man who's supposed to be setting. Imagine him running Columbia University.
Oh, dear.
Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been...
Well, let me encourage you to write your memoirs more extensively.
I'm going to finish it out. I tell you, another reason that I quit is my memory was going bad on me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes things or names that I ought to know, I had difficulty recalling them. I understand that's not unusual. I'm 81 and a half.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I'm still doing my own income tax and things like that.
Well, I wish you'd... I'm delighted to have this on tape.
Everybody says that to me. I sounded off to a vascular surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic because the laser was invented at Bell Laboratories.
Mm.
And when it was invented, I was always on a bet, what can we use this for other than communication? I suggested, since I was in the hospital business, that we try the hospital, maybe they could use it. And, since Alexander Graham Bell was deaf and he was interested in medical problems, we'll continue that tradition. So the only reputable place in the country that responded to our invitation to discuss it was the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out there. Showed me around. I was impressed. They said, well, we'll work with dogs. You supply the lasers. I said, I'll do better than that. I'll put two men in residence. not only to watch what you're doing, but to find out what you're doing so we can profit by it. We're only interested in medicine here. We're not going to try to sell it to the... And we had these two fellows out there for 4 years. And they actually quit and took a job at Cleveland Clinic. Great place. And when I found out they have a branch here in Fort Lauderdale on the highway 40 miles, but my wife and I moved here, she had trouble with a gallbladder. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew Judy would operate on her because she didn't have the classical symptoms. So I went down to the Cleveland Clinic. They said the same thing. I don't have the classical symptoms. And I said, well, look, let me be a doctor, will you? Why don't you feed her some ice cream, high in fat, high fat ice cream? Okay, we'll get the girl from, we have a girl who figures out menus to recommend it. She did that. 2 days later, Jenny woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. She says, I think I'm going to die. Terrible pains. Better call the Cleveland Clinic right away. So I called them. I got the guy who was in charge. He was a surgeon from New Jersey, by the way. He says, bring her right down. By the time she got there, she felt a little bit better, and he wanted to keep her overnight. I said, just stabilize her. We'll see what we do tomorrow. Well, the next day, the original surgeon who was reporting to this guy was his boss's on that night. He called up. He goes, boy, oh boy, that idea of yours worked. He said, look, that's classical gallbladder. Bad. He said, my boss was in there. He reamed me out for giving her that ice cream. He said, he could have killed her. I said, here, write a paper on it right away. They'll call it the Sestol test. The guy's name was Sestol. Go down in history, medical history. Geez, he was a little bit taken up about it. I was joking with him. But they took that bladder out, and the problems he had for years disappeared. When they took him out, they said it was like an old boot. It was full of stones, and it was like rubber, you know. That's good, the ice cream test, isn't it?
Yeah.
By the way, what is your... what is your exit time here or there?
I think we should be...
you want to have some lunch?
Do you want to just go, if it's not an inconvenience?
No, whatever you say.